Oh, trying to what?
Very nice.
By the way, in case it's of any interest to anybody, let me just give you my email. Sometimes people do ask me different questions, either when they're here or even when they leave. So my email is judge5, I'm not a judge, judge5@AOL.com. I do have the rare distinction of, am I the only one with AOL in this room?
No, I am.
Okay.
I don't use it.
I thought I was special.
But
okay.
I use
okay.
My first email.
Okay, all right, very good, okay. Because I am told it is actually impossible to drop AOL. Even if you want to drop them, you will continue to get charged. It's like literally like impossible to...
I have it still.
Even if you don't use it, do you still pay for it? I mean, once they have the...
I don't pay for it.
Somebody told me you can't... You can't cancel it. I don't know.
Okay. Wait, you pay for it?
I'm not sure. I think I do. I don't check. You know, I think I have $20 a month. I should get it for AOL for free.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe I get a big refund. Okay. You have to check. Yeah.
Wait, email. You should re-identify yourself.
Well, it depends what your preference is. You know, there's no reason not to identify yourself. But if it's an extremely private question, you want to be anonymous. I will answer anonymous questions too. Okay. Okay, so we're still in the middle of the first topic. We're doing organ donation, and last week we went through the problems of kidney donations, live organ donations, and the basic bottom line is relatively simple, although we talked about some complexities. The basic bottom line is that you are not obligated to put yourself in danger even to save another person's life, and halacha regards giving up a vital organ like a kidney or even part of your liver as at least incrementally increasing your danger. So there's no chiyuv. The word chiyuv means no obligation, but it is a meritorious, virtuous act if you're able to do so, and therefore it is not prohibited. It might be encouraged, but at the same time it's not an obligation. It is not a sin if you don't give up a kidney to somebody, as opposed to maybe bone marrow and certainly blood, where you're not endangering yourself in any way, that might actually be an obligation. Now, vis-a-vis non-Jews, in other words, do I have to give bone marrow to a non-Jew? That's a bit more of a question. Some rabbis will say that the obligation you have even extends to non-Jews. Other rabbis will say not. That's a very controversial question. But certainly if there's a Jew that needs a bone marrow transplant or blood, I should see myself as obligated to try to provide that blood, assuming, of course, with blood, of course, you have the issue that you need the type of blood, unless you're a type O or universal donor or the like. Now, we're now going to look very briefly at the other extreme, and that is what I call cadaveric organ donations. Now, that's not yet heart transplants. Cadaveric organ donations means the types of organ donations you can take from a dead body that's ready to go into the ground, meaning it is mamash dead. There's rigor mortis, and you want to take an organ. Now, cadaveric organ donations are really relatively rare because there's not a lot you can get from a truly dead body. The heart is not going to be suitable. Liver, kidney, lung, all of that goes kaput once the person is ready to be buried. The organs deteriorate very rapidly. But there are a few things that can be taken from a dead body. Skin survives for a while, so there can be skin grafts. And eyes, corneas or even eyes can survive for a while. So we're really not... So remember, when we talk about cadaveric organ donations, we're not talking about hearts, livers, kidneys, lungs. We are talking about eyes and corneas and skin. So what halachic problems do we have here? So here, right, what is the halachic area that we have to identify as potentially problematical that needs to be addressed? The answer is all of the many laws that concern the proper halachic treatment of dead bodies. And there is a concept in Jewish law, generically, that is called kavod hametz, or in Ashkenazic Hebrew, kavod hametz. Right, I assume you already understand Ashkenazic, Sephardic, Israeli Hebrew, and everything else. Okay, honor that we give to a dead body. Now let's stop a moment and think about this. You know, of course, that the ancient Egyptians had what was called a death cult. They worshipped the dead. That's why they built pyramids and everything else. Judaism does not worship the dead. We worship life. Now, we worship God, of course, but we consider life to be so important because it is only life that we can do the Torah and the mitzvot and become close to God. Now, this is very paradoxical, even though the ultimate connection to God is in the world to come. Right, so you might think we should look forward to death because then we'll go to the world to come. In fact, however, it is only the work of mitzvot and Torah learning and loving kindness that we do in this world that will perfect us in the world to come. Meaning to say, the world to come has to be based on this world. And this is why the Torah celebrates the idea of life. That is why every minute of life is very, very precious. There was a great rabbi who lived his whole life filled with Torah and mitzvot. And in his last moments on earth, he was crying because he was taking his tzitzit, his fringes, and he was saying, look how wonderful this world is, that for a few pennies that it takes to buy these fringes, one can acquire all of the wealth of the world to come. And once
why
you go...
Why are you guys tucking their tzitzit in the graveyard?
That's exactly right. That's a very, very good analogy. The halacha is, exactly as you said, that even if your tzitzit are out, you have to put them in when you're in front of a dead body or in a graveyard, because that is called making fun of a poor person, because the dead body, the neshama, can no longer do those commandments. And you also know, again, I'm going to overstep my boundaries and venture into chassidus, which I'm not supposed to do, but the idea is, that's why, as I'm sure you've learned this, that is why a human being is called a traveler, and an angel is called standing still. Angels are higher than us, right? We're below, and the angels are high, but they're stagnant, they're stationary. What they are is what they are. We have the capacity to journey, to travel, to grow. In fact, I believe the Friedrich Rebbe, the Rebbe before the Rebbe, once said, this is what you can learn from the game of chess. He says, you know, Chabad likes to learn something from everything. And in chess, the lowest piece is the pawn. The pawn is the lowliest piece. But only the pawn can transform itself into the queen. And that's really a remez. Remez means an allusion to the human condition. We are so low. We have so many base impulses within us. We have the animal soul. But we have the capacity of transformation. So the reason I went into this little digression, although I think it's an important meditation for Rosh Hashanah, is that if Judaism puts such a great emphasis on life, then once we have a dead body, there's no neshama, it's not even an animal soul in the dead body, just dead, why should I care that I bury it properly? I mean, let me just throw it into the garbage, meaning to say, it's just a physical body, there's nothing there. The answer is, the analogy would be to a Torah scroll. When you have a Torah scroll, right, the Torah is like the holiest thing we have. The cover of the Torah scroll is just a cloth. Just a cloth. There's nothing special about the cover. And yet, because the Torah scroll was contained within the cover must also be treated with reverence and respect. That's exactly the body. The body is nothing more than the nartik. The nartik is the case, the cover, the robe of the divine soul. But just as the mantle of a Torah scroll must be treated with reverence and respect, a physical, inert body must be treated with reverence and respect because it was the repository of the godly soul. Now that's why people sometimes misunderstand this. I'm sure you've heard expressions about don't speak ill about the dead. So people think, oh, when you're alive, I can do whatever I want to you. Once you're dead, I got to treat you with a lot of respect. It's really the opposite. The only reason we respect the dead is because it once was the cover, the repository of the life force of divinity. So what you really respect is the life force of the godly soul, and the body is just the case, right? So it makes no sense to say, I respect the mantle of the Torah, but I don't respect the Torah. You respect the mantle because that's how you respect the Torah, right? So people get it wrong. It's not that we treat the dead better than we treat the living. The other way around. We treat the dead with a lot of respect because it was the repository for the living soul. So because of this, there are many, many laws regarding respecting the dead. One of them was exactly what you mentioned, that you don't wear, now I shouldn't say you, because women wearing tzitzit is a whole other problem. Maybe we'll address it some other place. But at least traditionally, tzitzit is one of the mitzvot that women do not do. But whatever, whether it's tefillin or tzitzit or study of Torah, generally one does not do it in proximity to a cemetery. But most important, the most practical halacha is that this is why we insist on burial and cremation is absolutely forbidden. In fact, I don't know, unfortunately, a lot of people, particularly if they come from non-religious families, are often going to face this very big problem. So let me digress a little bit on that. Like we digress from topic to topic. This issue of cremation. Cremation is a great, great sin. And if there's anything you can ever do within your family to stop a cremation and encourage a Jewish burial, that is a tremendous, tremendous mitzvah. And not only is it a sin, but cremation causes tremendous spiritual anguish and pain to the soul. Now, you're not going to know that. We don't know, you know, because we're not with the soul. But according to our teaching, even if a person requested cremation and he or she thought that's exactly what they wanted. And unfortunately, cremation is getting very, very popular these days. Part of it is because it's cheaper, but whatever it is, a lot of people want cremation. And yet, even if that's what they say they want, that's not really what they want, because after they die, they're going to very much desire their body to be buried. So, frankly, I'm going to tell you something that might be a little shocking to you. That is, even if you made a solemn promise on a loved one's deathbed that you will cremate them, even if you made a promise, even if you swore, and normally taking an oath is a very, very severe undertaking, you are actually supposed to break that oath and bury. And if you think to yourself, how could I betray my parents' last wishes? All I can tell you is, according to our tradition, your parent will be much, much, much happier with a burial. Now, let's say, unfortunately, I don't mean to talk about any particular person, but let's say the person was unable to stop the cremation. And there was a cremation. This could happen for a lot of reasons. Sometimes one sibling might be religious and would try to stop the cremation, but another sibling might not. Or in a recent case that I had, a Jewish man was married to a non-Jewish woman. But the Jewish man has children from an earlier Jewish marriage, and the children are religious. So the children want to stop the cremation, but legally, the wife makes the final decision. So let's say, God forbid, a cremation does happen. So what happens? So this is a very interesting point in which there might be a difference between the classic statement of halacha and the way halacha is applied in practice. So that's why you need to know that. That's why you need an actual flesh and blood rabbi or spiritual advisor, because sometimes the halacha might say something in the book, but for various reasons, we sometimes don't apply it the way it is in the book. The halacha in the book says that if somebody was cremated, the mourner's kaddish is not recited for them, and the family does not sit shiva, they do not mourn for them, because this was such... Let me backtrack. I obviously don't mean involuntary cremation. I'm not talking about concentration camp victims. There, of course, we give them full honors to the degree that we can. I'm not talking about that, okay? Be sure you understand that. I'm talking about a voluntary decision to have a cremation. So under the strict halacha, a person who voluntarily cremated, the ashes are not allowed to be buried in a Jewish cemetery. Okay, half the time they don't want that anyway, but if they want that, that would not be the case. The family does not sit shiva. Shiva is the 7 days of mourning, and the mourner's kaddish is not recited, meaning they're kind of excluded. In practice, however, it is very different. And the reason why in practice we often say Kaddish and we often sit Shiva is because there is a concept in Jewish law that if people were raised not to really know about Judaism, they're like kidnapped babies. In other words, the example would be a baby was kidnapped and raised in Africa, so even if somebody was raised in America, they simply never knew better. And if they never knew better, they're not treated as intentional rishayim who are repudiating the Torah. And as a result, de facto, we generally do sit Shiva and we generally do say Kaddish. And that's why if God forbid any of you ever have such a situation, you need to talk to a rabbi exactly how to proceed. But, as I said, going back to my earlier remark, if we stop a cremation, that's a great, great mitzvah, and one should definitely stop a cremation if one can. By the way, the same difference between theory and practice is true in even a more tragic situation, and that is a suicide. Let's say, God forbid, somebody takes their own life. Now, under halacha, taking your own life is murder. Just like you can't murder somebody else, you can't murder yourself. According to the halacha, same type of rule. If somebody committed suicide intentionally, they are not buried in a Jewish cemetery, the family does not sit Shiva, and the mourner's Kaddish is not recited. But in practice, we have a catch-22. And the catch-22 is that the rules that penalize a suicide is only if the suicide did not act under extreme depression or kind of temporary insanity. And then we reason backwards and we say anybody who killed himself must have been kind of temporarily insane. So it's a different theory than the cremation. The cremation theory is people were raised without really knowing about this. For the suicide, the theory is that people were acting under extreme depression and anxiety. Although I do want to point out that during the Holocaust, when many, many non-Jews in concentration camps, because there were non-Jews in concentration camps too, committed suicide, the suicide rate among the Jews, who of course were suffering in the concentration camp, was very, very low. It's interesting that even under extreme circumstances, Jews did not take their life. They saw a purpose in their life, and they saw a reason to struggle and go on. And even if they wanted to die, and many did express a wish that God would take them out of their suffering, they would not do it themselves. The one notable exception, though, and it was very controversial at the time, was one of the Jewish heads of the Warsaw Ghetto, I think in 1943 or 45, Adam, it's a CZ something, you know, in Polish, you don't have any vowels, everything is consonants. He committed suicide because he couldn't take the suffering. Again, he was a good man. I mean, he couldn't take the suffering around him. So he committed suicide, but he was very, very criticized by the Jewish community for abandoning them in their time, he was not religious, in their time of need. So it's interesting that Jews believe in life, because Hashem tells us to believe in life, even when matters are very, very tough. Okay, so number one, going back to Kavod HaMetz, we're going to segue back to organ donation soon. Going back to Kavod HaMetz, we have the idea of no cremation. We also have the idea of no autopsies. Now, this could be a problem sometimes. Autopsies are sometimes mandatory by state law. For example, if somebody dies suspiciously, somebody might be the victim of a crime. So the law may require autopsies. Now, in the United States, a lot of states do have religious exceptions. So if the family says, our religion doesn't allow it, they will accommodate you. But in some countries and in some places, there is no such exception. In fact, of all places, in Israel, now, Baruch Hashem, now Israel does have an exception, but if you would go back 40 or 50 years ago in Israel, the autopsy law was extremely broad. Virtually every person who died was subject to a compulsory autopsy. And religious people used to steal dead bodies from the morgues. to bury, steal them away in the middle of the night. They would dress up as doctors in white coats or
orderlies. So they don't have to get an autopsy?
That's right, that's right, that's right. They would literally sneak into the hospital dressed as an orderly or a doctor and kind of take away the body. That's how bad it was. It really was a very, very difficult situation because Israel was allowing, not allowing, requiring autopsies in all sorts of cases. Now, Baruch Hashem, over the years, Israel is like the United States in that sense, that there is religious exemption. But certainly, autopsies are forbidden. If they have to be done, then you try to negotiate to do as little as possible. And even the organs that are cut up and subject to the autopsy should be reburied with the person. And that you can sometimes do. Again, just for your information, there are organizations in the United States that can protect you legally from autopsies. This would be a good as Israel of America and some other organizations. And they kind of have the legal connections to prevent autopsies and the like. Right, so that's another example of something that you don't do. Giving your body to science is absolutely forbidden according to halacha because a body has to be buried. You can't have it available in a medical school for anatomical dissection. That is a violation of the kavod of the body. Yeah.
So how would it work, like, if it, she was in medical school and you're working on anonymous bodies, like, could it potentially be working on it?
Yeah, so that is an excellent question. You're a medical student and you're doing anatomy. And they use cadavers, they actually use human bodies. So in the United States, the technical loophole would be that since most people who die in the United States are non-Jews, it may be that the autopsy restrictions are not as strict on non-Jews. Now that itself is an argument, but some rely on that argument and the like, so they will permit it. By the way, if you're a Kohen, not a female is not a problem, but if you're a male Kohen, you have another problem. You're not allowed to be in the same room as a dead body. So a Kohen effectively cannot go to medical school. If he's already a doctor, that's fine, but...
I thought they got excused.
Huh?
I thought they got excused.
I'm not aware of them getting excused. I would be very surprised,
but I'll
check
can't
it.
Be doctors?
Basically, a Kohen cannot be a doctor, meaning the Kohens that are doctors are balei tshuva, meaning to say they were not religious, and then they became doctors as not religious, then they became religious. But if you are a Kohen, again, this does not apply to women that are daughters of Kohens, but if you're a male Kohen, you actually cannot go to medical school. Now, there is a small movement, it's not really catching on that much, to replace actual anatomical dissection of human cadavers with computer-generated readouts. You know, you can now have 3D imaging, and some are saying that that would replace the need for a human cadaver, and they can work on a computer screen, just like a flight simulator. You can learn how to fly an airplane, so you can learn human anatomy through the 3D imaging on computers. But, as I say, I don't think that's catching on a lot because a lot of medical schools still feel, and maybe they're right, that it's not exactly the same as flesh and blood contact. So Kohanim do have problems. But you're right, theoretically, actual anatomical dissection would be a problem even for a non-Kohen because of the rules against autopsy, unless you can assume that it's non-Jewish. Now, in Israel, if you're in medical school in Israel, I think it's more of a question, because most of the residents of Israel are Jews, so halacha might assume that unidentified bodies would be Jewish bodies, as opposed to non-Jewish, because you always follow the majority, so that would be a very, very interesting problem. By the way, you may recall, there was a traveling exhibit, maybe it's still going on,
yes.
A few years ago, they were like exhibiting body parts and skeletons, what do they call it? They call it
body.
It was something where, yeah. So, number one, it would be a problem for Kohens to go to that. But number two, many rabbis said it was improper even for non-Kohens, any Jewish person, to go in, because this is exhibiting human remains. And that is not respectful. That is a violation of the honor and dignity of human bodies. And even if they're not Jewish, you shouldn't do it. So again, for medical training, maybe we'll be lenient, but we're not going to be lenient for recreational viewing and just have a good time. Although I'm not sure if it's the best type of date. Hey, let's go and see some remains. But whatever it is. By the way, you know, it's quite amazing. Around 5 years ago, I went with a group of students to Poland, and you know, Poland is quite a popular destination. There are many, many Jewish groups in Poland. Some people are critical of that because you're giving money to the people who ran concentration camps. But people go to the cities, Krakow and Warsaw, and they go to the concentration camps. So we went to Auschwitz, we went to all of the different places where Jews were destroyed. And at one of the places, which they built a monument, somebody was just looking at the dirt. And they found what looked like bone fragments to this very day. This is 60 years after the Holocaust. Then it was 60 years after the Holocaust. You could still find pieces of bone in the area of the crematorium mixed in with the, I don't know if it went, or maybe it was something else, but something, and then you have to kind of bury it and the like, those little fragments. Right, so generically, these are a bunch of rules that are called Kavod HaMet, honor for the dead body. Similarly, you may know, I don't know if you've ever been involved in this, but at some point in your life, it would be a great mitzvah to do. When a body is prepared for burial, it is washed, right? All the dirt and the blood is rinsed away. It's actually a bath that one gives. This is called a tahara, a purification. Its hair is shampooed. You shampoo the body, the hair, you comb it. And it's similar to a baby, the way you take care of a baby, the way you honor the dead. And then you put on the clean white garments, which are called tachrichim. Right, so all of this is a way of showing honor and homage to the body, because it once was the repository of the divine soul. So based on this, going back to organ donation, now we can segue back, one might assume that it should be very problematical to take skin, take eyes, take corneas from a dead body, because we are violating the rules against dissection and the rules against autopsy. So one would assume that it should be forbidden. However, this is not so much of a problem as you would assume, because although it's true that it is forbidden to do autopsies and it's forbidden to cut into corpses and it is forbidden to desecrate the dead, but if you're doing so to save a life, that would be much better. Because think about it this way. The laws against autopsy are not stricter than the laws against Shabbos. Now, if I can violate the laws of Shabbos to save a life, right, I can drive to the hospital or whatever it is, or if somebody needs to eat because otherwise they might die, they can eat chazer, or they could even eat on Yom Kippur. So yeah, autopsies are forbidden, 100%. But if you're doing it to save a life, it's going to be permitted. Autopsies is not one of the big three. Remember, there's only three sins for which you have to give your life before you transgress, right? Remember the big three? Idolatry. If somebody goes over to me and said, become a Christian or I'll kill you, you have to give your life. Sexual offenses. If somebody says to a man, have intercourse with this married woman or I'll kill you, the man must give his life. By the way, my example was deliberate. A woman that is passively being victimized by a rapist does not have to give her life, okay? And the third is murder. If I say to you, kill him or I'll kill you, you can kill me because I'm threatening you, but you cannot kill an innocent man to save your life. Those are called the big three. For the big three, you must give your life before you transgress. But for every other commandment, whether it's eating on Yom Kippur or keeping kosher or keeping Shabbos, the halacha is pikuach nefesh, saving a life overrides everything. Now, based on that, autopsies per se are forbidden, but when it can save a life, it will then be permitted. Yeah.
Couldn't you say that we're only allowed to desecrate Shabbos if you're saving a Jew's life?
Yeah, so that would be the same. I mean, if you make that argument, that would be the same thing here. In other words, whenever I say saving a life, I would be referring to a Jewish life, according to that
so,
idea.
But there's no guarantee that your organs are going to be going to
That's correct. Now, as a matter of fact, there actually is something. The organ donor community does not like it. There is something called targeted donation, where theoretically you can specify. But, you know, number one, it looks very bad for a person to say, I hereby donate my organs only to be used by a Jew. You know, from a superficial level, that sounds like the white man that says, I'm donating my organs only to be used by a white, and don't give it to a black. It sounds like a very racist, exclusionary statement. I'll address that. I'll address that a little later, but it is a good issue. But I'm just saying, in theory, if it's going to go to a Jew, it would be permissible. Now, according to this, by the way, so let me backtrack a minute. So why can't you make the following argument? In a lot of autopsies, let's say somebody dies of an illness, somebody dies of AIDS, somebody dies of cancer. When we do an autopsy, or when a pathologist does an autopsy, there may be medical information that you'll gain that may help eventually in the treatment of the illness. So the question becomes, why can't we allow every autopsy on the theory that it might yield information that is potentially life-saving, maybe 20 years in the future, and maybe only cumulatively with other autopsies and other types of information? So here, the poskim say that goes too far, because that's really like a fishing expedition. It's one thing if you have an organ that can save an immediate person. It's another thing to say, let's violate the Torah, because maybe in the long run we'll find out something. Meaning, when it's speculative and it's not going to a direct person that you can identify, so halacha does not permit it. Because that's like saying, you know, a doctor might say, oh, I'm going to eat a ham sandwich today because it'll give me energy in case one of my patients gets a heart attack, and I'll be more alert and I'll be able to help them. Well, you know, you can't just make guesses like that, that these things will happen. So, okay. Now, the Jew versus the non-Jew problem is a real good question. I'll get to a little later. But I want to focus on another question. So it turns out that for autopsies, we can adopt the following rule. Forbidden unless it is potentially life-saving for an identified person. Okay. Now, here's my question. I had said before that cadaveric organ donations, the only things you can get, really, there's not that much you can get from a cadaver. You can get eyes, corneas, and skin. Well, is that life-saving? That's not like a heart or a liver, right? Eyes, corneas, skin. I mean, it's true that a corneal transplant might, say, prevent or alleviate blindness. So here, the poskim have a very interesting argument. The poskim argue that there is a statement in the Talmud that says a blind person is considered dead. That might mean spiritually, or it just might mean that when a person is blind, they are subject to all sorts of dangers because a bus might hit them, you know, they don't see things, and the like. So the poskim have said that blindness is treated as a potentially life-threatening condition. And because it is treated as a potentially life-threatening condition, corneal transplants taken from cadavers are actually permitted. That's very, very interesting. What about skin? So that would depend. It would depend where the skin is going to go. If the skin is going to go to burn victims who potentially can die unless they have healthy skin, that would be called pikuach nefesh. If it's going to go for tummy tucks or some cosmetic surgery, then it would be prohibited. So you would have to specify. Now again, the Jew versus Goy, that's controversial, but you could specify that it should go for burn victims or the like, and that request would be respected. Okay, so this is really the issue of cadaveric organ donation. Again, as I say, there's not a lot to say on it. The main issue simply is that autopsies are forbidden unless it is a matter of pikuach nefesh, and then we have to define what is pikuach nefesh in the case of blindness and skin grafts and the like. Now, the big question is, as you pointed out, and that is, well, yeah, but in the United States, you don't know, or anywhere really, you don't know where the skin or the corneas are going to go. Are they going to go to a Jew? Are they going to go to a Goy? are you allowed to do autopsies in order to save the life of a non-Jew? Some say you're not allowed to do that. That's going to be a good question. According to that, you might not be allowed to authorize a cadaveric organ donation unless you can target it that it would go to a Jew. Okay. Right, so this is the category number two. So we've talked about two categories. We've talked about the category of organs taken from a live person, and we've talked about organs that are taken from a clearly dead person, a cadaver, and these are kind of the halachic issues that one needs to consider. We now come really to the most controversial and most difficult area, and that is vital organs that are removed from people who are between dead and alive. And this gets us into the issue of what is called brain death. Now, this was way before any of you were born, but the first heart transplant was, I think, in 1967 or 68. And this was in Cape Town, South Africa. And the physician who did it was a surgeon, Dr. Christian Barnard, a very, very great heart surgeon. And later, Michael DeBakey in Houston, Texas, also pioneered in the United States, and the like. Now, the initial heart transplant operations, I should say, were actually a failure, meaning to say every recipient died within 3 days. But that was still so it was, why did people agree to this? Because here's the point. You were dealing with people who were going to die in a week. They were going to die in a week. So if the transplant would be successful, they get life. And if not, they die quicker, but they thought it was reasonable to put their 1 week at risk because of the potential. But Lamaisa, the way it worked was, the recipients died earlier than they would have died had there not been a transplant. So heart transplants initially were totally a failure, but there was a learning curve as the procedure improved, etc. Eventually, heart transplants became a relatively successful operation, and there are people who can survive with a heart transplant in reasonable health for 5 years, even up to 10 years, right? So that's nothing to laugh about. 5 or 10 years of reasonable life is a great, great blessing that one can get. But here is the problem. Here is the conceptual problem with a heart transplant. Nobody's going to say, let's take a heart from a person that's alive. That would be murder, right? No one's going to say, hey, Uncle Joe is pretty sick anyway, let's just take his heart and bury him and give it to Jimmy. That's called murder. On the other hand, if you wait until somebody was dead in the classical sense, the heart muscle rapidly deteriorates and it's not suitable for transplantation, because the heart muscle deteriorates around less than 5 minutes, really, after there is death. So as a result, heart transplants necessitated a redefinition of the legal standard of death. And this really was a revolution. So now I'm taking off my rabbi hat and I'm putting on a lawyer hat. And I'm going to give you a little legal information, and then we'll measure that legal information against the halacha. If you would look in a law dictionary, anybody here a lawyer by any chance?
Is this specifically in America, legal definition?
Well, yes, but this will apply almost internationally as well, meaning much of what I say is not limited to America. It applies to virtually every, what you call, first world country, certainly all of Europe and the like. If you would look in a legal dictionary around 50 years ago, you would see the following definition of when is a person dead. A person is dead when there is, now each word is important here, irreversible cessation of vital signs, including respiration, heartbeat, and circulation of blood. Now, that basically means you were not dead until two things happened, and both of those things had to be irreversible, meaning you couldn't reverse them. One is, you're no longer breathing. And number two, there is no heartbeat, meaning there's no pulse, and therefore there's no circulation of blood. Now, if that just stopped for a short time and that was reversible, you were still alive. Right? So it's important to know that superimposed on these two conditions is irreversibility in a clinical sense. Meaning it had to be the opinion of the attending physicians. Now, people could abuse that. That, number one, there was a cessation of breathing. Number two, there was a cessation of heartbeat and pulse. And number three, it could not be resuscitated, meaning to say it was irreversible. When those three things happened, a person was declared dead. Once a person is dead, you bury him, or you could take organs, but the point was, that classical definition of death would not have allowed a heart transplant. If you had to wait until the heart stopped beating to take out the heart would not be suitable for transplantation. So as a result, starting in the early 1970s, Harvard University developed alternative, Harvard University Medical School developed alternative criteria for death, which eventually became known as brain death. And this has a lot of names, but they're all the same. Brain death, whole brain death, there's a third name that escapes me right now, but that means the following: that even if a person still has heartbeat and circulation of blood, the person can be declared dead based on neurological criteria that the entire brain has been destroyed. And this is called brain death, and this is the legal standard of death in all 50 of the United States, in virtually all of Western Europe. And in fact, it actually was the definition of death in the state of Israel until a few years ago. Now, you have to understand a little bit of science here, so I'm going to be very, very simple. And that is, what is the difference between brain death and traditional death? So here's the thing you need to know. Obviously, the heart is not going to beat without oxygen. So in the olden days, when you stopped breathing, your heart stopped also, because without oxygen, the heart is not going to beat. But with the development of respirators, which are artificial breathing machines, it is possible that I'm no longer capable of breathing because the respiratory center of the brain stem, has been destroyed, but oxygen is going in. And why is the heart beating? If there's no brain, how could the heart beat? The answer is, surprisingly enough, the heart has its own independent pacemaker. As long as the heart muscle gets oxygen, it will continue to pump blood even if there is no brain that is controlling it. That's very amazing. Meaning, the heart, at least for a time, is not directly controlled by the brain. What the brain does is, the brain controls respiration and oxygen intake, which keeps the heart alive, but even when the brain is destroyed and there is no respiration that is being conducted by the brain, right? The brain is not directing the lungs to take in air. If the air is coming in purely mechanically, the heart is beating naturally. It's not machine beating. The heart is beating naturally by virtue of its own pacemaker. And thus, it is entirely possible to have a brain-dead person on a respirator whose heart beat is beating naturally, who has a pulse, who has a body temperature, blood is circulating. 50 years ago, that person would be called alive. Today, I'm talking legally now, that person is deemed dead. We can cut into his beating chest, assuming the family has given consent, and we can take his organs. So you understand the chiddush. Again, if there wouldn't be a respirator, this debate would be irrelevant. Because whether you define death by the brain or you define death by cessation of heartbeat, in the olden days, without a respirator, if there was no oxygen, the heart stopped beating too. But this is a relevant debate only because we now have mechanical ventilation that can supply the oxygen, even though there's no brain that's doing respiratory activity. So one has to understand that the legal basis that allows heart transplants is the redefinition of death to include brain death. Now, brain death is established by neurological criteria. It involves a number of discrete tests. First of all, some have a scanning to show that there's no circulation of blood into the brain at all. That actually means that the pressure in the skull is greater than the blood pressure, so there is no penetration of blood into the skull. Number two, they shine a light into the pupils, and the pupils do not dilate. Number three, they jab a needle, and there's no pain response. There's no involuntary response. Number four, they determine that the patient is 100% respirator dependent, and there's not even a tiny bit of breathing activity on his own. And there are other tests as well. These are neurological tests to determine that the brain is destroyed. So even though, you understand the chiddush means the innovation, even though the heart is beating and the blood is circulating and there's pulse and there's body temperature, legally that patient is declared dead and organs can be harvested, life support can be turned off because the person is not considered alive anymore. If I shoot, under criminal law, if I shoot a brain dead person, I don't go to jail because he's considered dead already. Now, let me point out a very important distinction, and again, for those that have some scientific background, this is obvious to you. Do not confuse brain death with people in a coma called a persistent vegetative state. Do not confuse them. They are very, very different. People in comas may lack higher mental functioning. Maybe we don't even know exactly, but they may be unable to communicate. They may be unconscious. But, and we may colloquially talk about them, although it's not a respectful way, as vegetables, or we may even use the word brain. They're brain dead. But that is a misnomer, even though their cerebral functions are impaired, their brain stem is still controlling their autonomous body functions. Not only circulation of blood, but breathing. In fact, many people in deep comas are not on respirators. They're breathing on their own. A person in a coma, even legally, is absolutely alive. If you murder a person in a coma, you will go to jail. And you cannot take organs legally. Again, I'm putting on my legal hat here. You cannot legally take organs from a person in a coma, that is treated as murder. Okay, do not confuse at all neurological brain death with persistent vegetative state. You may recall the tragic case a few years ago of Terry Schiavo, a woman in Florida who was in a persistent vegetative state for 15 years. And the courts did allow disconnection of life support, which was very, very tragic in and of itself. But she was not dead, even under a legal definition. She was not brain dead. She was not on a respirator. Her body was able to digest food and the like. Brain dead is very different. There is no circulation of blood into the brain. There is no sensation in pain. There is no response to light that is shined in the pupil. And there is no capacity for breathing because the respiratory center of the brain has been destroyed. It is brain death that allows organ donation, even though the heart is beating. And that's why the heart is fresh. It is suffused with blood, and therefore we cut it out and we transplant it. Now, this itself, I think, should give rise to certain ethical concerns. Because, in a sense, right, did anyone here, I'm sure you read as children, Alice in Wonderland, and in the second volume, Through the Looking Glass, we are introduced to the character Humpty Dumpty. And Humpty Dumpty mentions, he used a certain word, I don't even remember all the details, but he used a certain word in an unusual way, and Alice corrected him, and Humpty Dumpty remarked, words mean whatever I want them to mean, and if I want them to mean this, they mean this, and when I don't want them to mean this, they don't mean that. Here is the problem. Under the old definition of death, people whose hearts were beating were alive. Right? They were alive. The day before Christian Barnard did his heart surgery, those donor people were alive. Now, if they're alive, we can't do heart transplants. But we want to do heart transplants because they're good, they're useful, they're helpful. So what do? We redefine death to say, okay, instead of this person being alive, we'll call him dead, and now we can do it. Meaning, you're redefining a term in order to get a result that you consider beneficial. Do you see the ethical reasoning problem there? In other words, you're turning... I'll give you an example from a very unlikely source, and I did not see this, but you know the cartoon show South Park, which is obscene and disgusting in many, many ways. But I once read in the newspaper an excerpt from South Park where one of the teachers wanted to kill one of the students for being a brat. And of course, it's against the law to murder, but it's permitted to have an abortion. So the teacher like shot the kid, and in South Park that apparently happens all the time, and just said, all this is a late-term abortion in the 850th month. Meaning, you call it an abortion instead of murder, and then it becomes okay, at least in secular society. For as far as we're concerned, it's not okay. Now, the James Watson, who is the co-founder of DNA, I'm sorry, co-discoverer of DNA, together with Frick, actually made such a proposal. He made this proposal, it's an outrageous proposal, in which you get rid of ethical problems by manipulating words. People had a problem with newborn children that are born with serious birth defects. And the problem is, if you catch it before the kid is born, then again, in secular society, not in Judaism, you can abort. But if you don't catch the problem till the kid is born, right, from a secular perspective, you're stuck because you can't kill a baby. So he thought that was unfair, because just because they didn't catch it. But how do you get around it? So he said, well, let's redefine birth. Because if law makes a distinction between pre-birth and post-birth, then let's just manipulate birth. Instead of saying birth occurs when most of the head is out of the uterus, let's just say birth occurs 72 hours after emergence from the birth canal. That way, you have 3 days to kill the kid, because we'll just call it late term abortion. Now, you see what's going on here. This is Humpty Dumpty ethical analysis. This is, on one hand, you have this ethical rule, I can do things before birth and I can't do things after birth. Although, again, halacha does not even accept that ethical rule. But that's the ethical rule of secular society, is we can do stuff before the kid is born, we can't do stuff after the kid is born. Right? That's the secular ethic. We then say, but I want to do something after the kid is born. Okay, we'll just say that even after he's born is still before he's born, because we'll redefine birth to be later. You can't do that, because then you're not taking your ethical lines seriously. You are simply redefining them to do whatever you want to do. And in a way, brain death followed that same trajectory, because We can't take a heart from somebody who's alive, but we could take a heart from somebody who's dead. But this donor is alive, so I can't take his heart. So what do? No. I change my dictionary definition and call him dead, based on brain death.
It's really fishy that it was at Harvard Medical School, no?
Yes.
But
in defense of Harvard Medical School, let me just say that Harvard Medical School, their criteria in the 1970s were not to define death. They wanted to define when is coma irreversible. It was irreversible coma. Later, it was taken to be a criteria of death.
And was there like a lot of moral discussion about that?
Yes, there is a lot of there was a lot of moral discussion. It died down for a few decades. Mm-hmm. Now it's coming back again. It's very, very interesting. 60 Minutes, you know, had a story. And again, you understand, I'm giving you legal background. This is going to be helpful for you. I know that you thought maybe you walked into a college classroom instead of a shiur. But you know, this is really important, because to understand the halacha, you have to know the scientific, medical, and legal background. And then you'll be able to evaluate what halacha says about all of this. Different neurologists have argued for many, many years, is brain death a valid criteria, is it not a valid criteria, and the like. Also, let me point out that there is also occasional misdiagnosis, meaning even if you accept that if the brain is totally destroyed, the person is dead, sometimes there are diagnostic errors in which we thought somebody was brain dead and they were not. In fact, there are stories, again, you don't prove things from one in a million stories, but there are some stories about a teenage kid, not Jewish, who was declared brain dead. He was taken off life support. His parents tearfully consented to his being a donor of vital organs. And when he's on the operating table as a dead body and the surgeons are about to cut in and remove his heart, he wakes up and starts talking. Uh-oh. Well, I think some doctor goofed there. I don't know what happened to the doctor. That would be a pretty, well, maybe I shouldn't be so concerned about the doctor's embarrassment, but it's a pretty embarrassing situation to be in. So that's a whole other issue, meaning even if brain death is acceptable as a definition of death, what about the occasional misdiagnosis? That's something to think about very, very much. But okay, by the way, I want to mention one other point about brain death you need to know. And that is, you need to know that unlike comas, a persistent vegetative state that a person could stay for many, many years, you could be 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, in fact, you could be 60 years, and there were. In fact, this person just died, maybe one of the world's most famous neurologists, Oliver Sacks. Have you heard of Oliver Sacks? In fact, he just died, died maybe 2 weeks ago. Interesting man. You know, he made his fame, I don't know if scientifically he was one of the world's great neurologists, but he wrote about many of his cases.
He just wrote an article about Shabbat.
That's correct. Very, very interesting. He apparently came from a religious family. He left it. He happened to become a gay person, but beside that, but he talks about as he felt he was reaching the end of his life, he wanted to reconnect to Shabbat, and he wrote a very, very very gifted writer, and he wrote a very beautiful article about coming back to God, and he compared it to dying, in which you've done your work and now it's time to go back to God, just like dying is going back to God. Well, maybe the analogy is a little, so every Shabbat you kind of die, meaning in the positive sense that you now go back to God after your world of work and the like. But he made his career, his very first book was about his treatment of people who were in comas from World War I. They were in comas then for 50 years at the point that he wrote the book. So you can be in a persistent vegetative state for many years. You cannot be brain dead for many years, meaning the following. I believe that medically, from the time a person, even if you leave a person on a respirator, the maximum length of time that a brain dead person's heart will continue to beat on a respirator is around 6 months. So we're not, this is not a Terry Schiavo case. Somebody is not going to be on a respirator for 100 years, as is the case with a coma. There is what is called respirator cardiac arrest. Eventually what happens is that, in other words, the heart's pacemaker is kind of like a reserve battery, meaning normally the brain is controlling the heart as well. When the brain shuts off, there is a pacemaker, but the pacemaker kind of wears out after a while. That's important to know, because if, God forbid, someone has a person that's declared brain dead, if halakhically we try to keep them alive, the family needs to know that we're not talking about years and years and years and years. It's relatively short term, but you may have to keep the person alive. Okay. We also have cases where brain dead women were kept alive to be able to bring a child to term. Quite amazing. They're brain dead, but we keep them on a respirator not to harvest their organs, but simply to enable them to bring their babies to term. Brain dead, now that's pretty funny. Not funny, I didn't mean funny, but that's pretty bizarre. Are you telling me a dead woman can give birth to a baby? I mean, you're telling me legally, a brain dead person is dead. But if a brain dead person is dead, right, you're allowed to shoot them legally. Then how does a dead body carry a baby? Moreover, dead bodies don't have body temperature. Brain dead people have body temperature. And anyway, how can it be brain dead? Temperature itself is controlled by the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain. So you're speaking out of two sides of your mouth. You're calling this person brain dead, and yet there can be pregnancy, nurturing of a child, and there can be body temperature, which is controlled by the hypothalamus. So that is why in the general community there is some concern about brain death. Number one, in terms of misdiagnosis, like the kid who wakes up, that's pretty serious. And number two, conceptually, it may not really be a definition of death because there's body temperature and various other functions. And of course there's heartbeat, albeit from the pacemaker. Yeah.
So what part of the brain did you say causes brain death?
Brain death is really the brain stem. The brain stem is not the frontal part of the brain.
Still creating hormones.
Yes, there may be some hormonal creation, meaning it's not 100% destruction. But as I say, there is no sensation or response to stimuli, light, pain, and no breathing, meaning we have to determine that respiratory activity is at 0%, that would be a declaration of brain death. And again, there are different protocols. It may have to be done twice over 24 hours. You know, it has to be done more than once to be sure that... But even then, as I said, we have some anecdotes that sometimes there were momish mistakes that were made, although it's very hard to understand. Now, if the diagnosis is accurate, it is irreversible. It is very... I think that much I will give the medical community, that a brain-dead person is incapable of recovery beyond a supernatural, miraculous occurrence. Again, maybe you've misdiagnosed brain death, but if it has been accurately diagnosed, there is no recovery from that point. Okay. So now we have, I think you have a pretty good grasp of the legal and medical basic information about this problem. So let's now ask, you know, we're Jews, we want to follow halacha, we want to follow God's will. When is a person dead? Because this is very critical. Organ donation either becomes the greatest mitzvah or the biggest aveira. How's that? If I have a donor, and the donor has been declared brain dead, but his heart is beating because the oxygen that is being supplied mechanically enables the heart to function by virtue of its own pacemaker. I need to know, from the perspective of Jewish law, is that donor alive or is that donor dead? If the donor is dead, the only sin I'm committing is autopsy. And to save a life, that would certainly be permitted. It becomes a mitzvah. But if that donor is alive, when I cut into him and I remove his heart, I am committing murder. And as I say, you cannot commit murder to save another life. So, you can't be neutral here. If halacha accepts brain death as death, organ donation becomes a mitzvah, at least if it might go to a Jew. If halacha does not accept brain death, then organ donation is a sin of murder, not autopsy, murder. And if it's murder, it cannot be allowed even to save a life. You understand? Even if this brain dead person is only going to live for another 6 months or another week, I cannot terminate his life to save somebody who might live many years, because that's the rule, that you can't kill one person to save another person. So that is why this is a very, very, very controversial issue. Because it's either the greatest mitzvah or the greatest aveira. Okay, you can't be neutral on this particular issue. And it all depends on whether halacha accepts the concept of brain death as death. Now, if we were to ask ourselves, what is the definition of death? We could answer spiritually, death is when the godly soul leaves a person. Okay, that's true. When the godly soul leaves a person, the person is dead. But how do we know when the godly soul leaves a person? Now, you might think superficially, well, when the person cannot do mitzvot, when they cannot communicate. But that would be saying too much, because if you say that, then maybe people with Alzheimer's are considered dead? Certainly not. People in comas are considered dead? Certainly not. People with profound retardation are considered dead? Certainly not. Meaning you have to understand that the godly soul can exist within a human being even when they're not capable of expressing it. So you really don't know when the godly soul leaves. We can only do so by physical tests, meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu entrusted us to determine the passage of the soul by various standards. So the question becomes, what are the physical standards that we use? So we're not able to go into all of the material here, source material. I just want to give you a structured answer and then give you a few proofs on either side of it. So you'll see it's a debatable. Like everything, you have to ask, I'm sure you've come across this abbreviation, your LOR, right? LOR is your local Orthodox rabbi, okay, for guidance. Because different rabbis will paskin differently on this. Most rabbis in Israel and most of the, what you might call right wing, most of the yeshiva, stricter rabbis, do not accept brain death as an acceptable halachic criterion. Now, why they don't accept it could be different reasons, meaning they don't have the same reason why they don't accept it, but there is a common denominator that they do not accept it. Some don't accept it because even if they accept it in theory, they are concerned for misdiagnosis, meaning they accept it in theory, but they are concerned with the 1 in 1,000 chance you might be murdering somebody who's really not brain dead. That's one aspect. Others don't accept it in theory by saying as long as the heart is beating, the person is alive. And I'll give you some proofs for that. Others say, we're not sure if life depends on breathing or life depends on blood. It is what is called a safek. Safek means a doubt. And in cases of doubt, you cannot take the initiative to possibly kill somebody. Right? So there are three different, in other words, of those who reject brain death, there are four different reasons why they reject it. Some reject it because of misdiagnosis. Some reject it because they say as long as the heart is beating and blood is circulating, the person is alive even if the brain is dead. A third group says it is halachically doubtful, are you dead or alive, so we can't take the chance of killing you. A fourth group says brain death is not really brain death because there's the hypothalamus and pregnancy and hormonal functions, and therefore if there would be true brain death, maybe that's so, but what medicine calls brain death is not really brain death. Right? So within the school that does not accept brain death, there are four different halachic reasons that are given. Different rabbis give different reasons. Bottom line, however, is you cannot cut into a brain dead body to remove a heart because it's either vadai murder, meaning certainly murder, or doubtful murder. Now, so this would be the position, I'll mention a few names just as this is the position of great rabbis, many of them are not alive anymore today. This was the position of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, a great, great tzaddik and posek who died around 25 years ago. This was the position of Rav Yosef Shalom Elyoshev, who died 3 years ago at the age of 102. This was the position of Rav Shmuel Vosner of Bnei Brak, who died just Pesach time. Again, many, many, many rabbis. Now, there are other rabbis who actually say halacha does accept brain death, and therefore they consider organ donation to be a great mitzvah. The greatest one who followed this was Rav Avadia Yosef, who was the great Sephardic leader. Although this was not his original position, but towards the end of his life, he endorsed brain death. And in the United States, most rabbis that are called modern Orthodox rabbis, and again, I'm not going to opine on the validity of all of that, most modern Orthodox rabbis have supported and do support the idea of brain death. And the leading proponent of halachic acceptability of brain death in the United States is Rabbi Moshe Tendler, who is both a rabbi and a posek and a professor of biology at Yeshiva University. It's a rabbi in Rabbi Moshe Tendler, T-E-N-D-L-E-R. He is the son-in-law of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who is considered to be the greatest of the poskim of the 20th century, and he goes all over the world, even at an advanced age, to try to push for the acceptability of brain death. So, if this is an area that sounds very confusing to you, it is very confusing. If you go to the website I told you about, Halachic Organ Donor Society. And that's abbreviated HODS, H-O-D-S, I think it's .org, because it's not for profit. The owner of that website is a strong advocate that Jews should donate organs. And he brings all the, actually he's even in it, he brings both sides, but he emphasizes the rabbis who are in favor of organ donation. But as I say, that's only part of the group. And all I can say is, without getting personal, that halacha is not only decided by quantity, it's decided by quality. And I have to say that perhaps the quality of halachic scholarship on the other side is greater than the quantity. Right? So numerically, there might be more rabbis in favor of organ donation, but it is a serious issue. Now, let me just point out, I'll give you a little proof, one proof on each side, just so you get the sense of the proofs. The proponents of brain death have two sources that they use for their argument. One is a biblical source and one is a Talmudic source. The biblical source is in Genesis, in Bereshit. When God creates Adam, so how is the creation of man described? Vayipach biyapav, God breathed into man the Spirit of God. The godly soul enters through the capacity of breathing. Right? God gave us mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. I'm sure you learned the passage in the Tanya, which is from the Zohar, that man danafich, that when I blow air into you, I am blowing from my essence. So too, when God breathed into us, it was God's life force. So, that's a Kabbalistic idea, but they take it halachically. If the divine soul enters through the process of breathing, the destruction of the respiratory capacity is what defines a person as dead or alive. And that is why they endorse brain death as acceptable. Of course, I do want to raise a question. Again, this is much more complicated than you assume, because let me point out the following. Respiratory capacity can be destroyed not only by brainstem destruction. There are illnesses that can destroy respiratory capacity even if the brainstem is intact. Two examples. One is ALS. ALS is popularly called Lou Gehrig's disease. Awful, awful, awful sickness. In Lou Gehrig's disease, the brain is fine. The person understands, the person is fully conscious. But the muscles of the body and the nerves no longer convey electrical impulses. And eventually he cannot breathe. Now, if you're going to go with the idea that the godly soul comes in through respiration, and when there's a destruction of a respiratory capacity, the person is dead, and that is your defense of brain death, then why do you have to be in a coma? Declare every ALS patient dead and shoot him or take his heart. So the point I'm making is, even they would not say an ALS patient is dead. The other example is polio. Now, Baruch Hashem, well, polio has not been eradicated. It's been far from eradicated. In fact, even Israel had a polio outbreak last year. But polio has been greatly minimized because of the vaccination. But you do know, there's a little bit of a debate now within the religious world that, you know, there are people who refuse to have their children vaccinated. They think that vaccination causes autism. And this is a thing that goes back for 50 years, but, you know, it comes up all the time. It's been discredited. But in the United States, there is at least one very prominent rabbi who has been influenced by his wife, who is an anti-vaccination activist, who has come out and said that people shouldn't vaccinate their kids because of the dangers. So God forbid, if too many people start following that, we may be getting things that we have not had for many, many years. But before the polio vaccine, which I think was in the late 1950s, kids got polio. I mean, it was very, very prevalent in the United States. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President Roosevelt. In those days, they would not take pictures of people, unlike today. The press agreed never to photograph him in a wheelchair. Kind of very amazing that people shouldn't lose respect for the president or whatever. But sometimes when polio is advanced, it paralyzes the lung. And you have to have an iron lung, right? So all I'm saying is, the concept that when there's no respiratory capacity, you're dead, does not apply across the board, even like those opinions, because ALS or polio would not be considered dead. Okay. Now, the second, that's the biblical proof. The biblical proof is from the creation of man, in which the divine soul enters through breathing. The Talmudic proof is a Mishnah in Maseches Oalos. And the Mishnah in Maseches Oalos talks about animals. It's not even talking about human beings. But you know, if an animal dies without being slaughtered, if it's slaughtered, it is ritually pure. But if an animal dies without being slaughtered, not only is it treif, you can't eat it, but it also makes you tameh. If I touch it, I become impure and I have to go to the mikveh. That doesn't apply to a hamburger that was shechted. So the Mishnah discusses, what if a cow was decapitated, but it's still convulsing, or a chicken? Right? Is it considered a dead animal, so I become tameh? Or is it considered a live animal, so I'm still tahor? Right? A chicken, right? The chicken, you know the expression chicken without a head? There is still neurological activity, electrical impulses, even after decapitation. So the Mishnah says, once an animal is decapitated, it is halachically considered dead, even if there's intermittent convulsion. So Rabbi Tendler coined an elegant phrase. Anatomical decapitation equals death. He said, brain death is physiological decapitation. Meaning, yes, the neck hasn't been severed. But if there's no connection between the brain and the body, then in terms of function, it is equivalent to decapitation. Right, so he coined the phrase that if the Mishnah establishes anatomical decapitation equals death, then why not physiological decapitation? My argument against Rabbi Tendler would be that decapitation is not a good metaphor, because obviously the brain is controlling some functions in the body. Maybe it's not controlling respiration, but it's not totally decapitated in that sense. Okay. Now, the other side has a proof from the biblical prohibition against eating of blood. We know Jews don't eat blood. That's why we salt our meat. In fact, by the way, you know, this is very interesting. You know, sometimes restaurants, I don't want to scare you, but sometimes there are unscrupulous restaurants that there are scandals in which if they're running short of meat, they'll buy non-kosher meat and they'll serve it to the patrons in the kosher restaurant. And sometimes restaurants are closed. This is less of a problem in Israel, but in the States it sometimes happens, where a lot of people showed up in the restaurant, so we send the guy to Safeway to buy some non-kosher chicken. And then, that doesn't happen a lot, but there are occasional scandals, and when this is caught, the restaurant is closed down, sometimes in the middle of a meal. I'm aware of cases where in the middle of dinner, the mashgiach comes in, it says, everybody stop, the restaurant is being closed. It should never happen to you, but it happens sometimes. Now, you know how mashgichim test if the meat is kosher or not kosher? One of the ways they test it, and they're allowed to do this, is they, you know, put their finger, you know, they kind of take a little juice, they put it on their tongue, and if it's not salty, they know it's treif meat. Why? Because all kosher meat and chicken is heavily salted, even though it's rinsed off, but it's heavily salted before it's served to drain the blood. So even if it's rinsed, there's still a lot of salt in it. Non-kosher meat is not salted. So one of the ways they actually tell is if the juice does not taste salty, it is treif meat. That's actually the test that they... So the rule is they keep it on their tongue. They don't swallow it, and then they wipe it off. They're allowed to... it's a very limited test for that purpose. That's why, by the way, if you're if you have high blood pressure and you're on a salt-free diet, you have to be careful about... even if you can eat regular meat, but salted meat is a problem. So you're advised to eat broiled meat, because broiled meat, like liver, does not have to be salted that much, because the broiling takes out the blood, right? Okay, but be it as it may, the Torah says don't eat blood, and the reason why it says don't eat blood is the following. This is in Leviticus: Hadam hu hanefesh, the soul is in the blood, which suggests that the life force of Hashem in the human being resides in the blood. So as a result, these other rabbis argue, as long as the blood is circulating, there is a soul. You see, in other words, you have an interesting contradiction here that you need to explore, and that is, Genesis suggests that the soul is connected to the breathing activity. Leviticus suggests that the soul is connected to the blood activity. And because of this, now you could differentiate. You could say, and indeed the Tanya says this, the animal soul is in the blood, but nevertheless, even the animal soul is entitled to life. You can't murder the animal soul either. So these are different proofs. So as a result, whether a Jew should give an organ or not give an organ will very much depend on the brain death debate. If you were to ask me, I would say that the halachic consensus seems to be against brain death, and therefore organ donation would not be encouraged. But there are many, many rabbis in the United States, and Rav Avadia Yosef, who is a great, great Talmud Chacham here, who does endorse brain death. And again, as I say, don't be concerned with autopsies. Autopsies are not the problem, because if it's going to go to save a life, it's perfectly good. The only issue here is whether brain death is murder. That's really the issue. Because if halachically the donor is alive, there is still going to be a problem of murder. Now, I do have a little bit more to talk about. I'll save it for next time. But I just want to mention one. I'll throw out a question, and then we'll discuss it next time. And that is, let's say that after hearing a class like this, you've taken a strict view, and you've decided it's forbidden to give organs. Let's assume that's your position. The question is, if you need it, are you allowed to receive organs? Meaning, must there be consistency in your position? Meaning, I'll give you an example, a very practical example. The overwhelming majority of, let's say, ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel will not consent to organ donation. They will consider it a desecration. But quite a few Jews, if they're not healthy, will put themselves on organ recipient lists, and they are willing to receive an organ. So one hard question you have to ask yourself is, if I maintain I'm not allowed to give, then under what halachic reasoning would I be allowed to receive an organ that was not allowed to be removed? Okay? Question. And yet, I can tell you that the asymmetry clearly exists. People who would never consent to an organ donation are perfectly willing to receive organs if that's necessary. So we'll discuss next time if that is proper and is there a halachic basis for it. We'll also discuss, if the organs are already removed, what priority rules does halacha have? Who gets the organ first when there's not enough to go around? Right? How do you allocate? Now that's a variation of many scarcity questions. How do you allocate dialysis machines, ICU beds, and the like? Okay. I gather tomorrow night, next week is Rosh Hashanah, so I want to wish you all a Shana Tova Mesukai, a good year and a sweet year. Gesiva B'chasima Tova, God should inscribe all of us in the Book of Life for a year of peace and a year of Shalom. The week after that, I don't know, is there a class in 2 weeks, do you know?
Well, is Yom Kippur?
Yeah, when is Yom Kippur? Rosh Hashanah is Monday, Tuesday, so Yom Kippur is also Sunday night. No, one second. Rosh Hashanah is Monday, Tuesday, so Yom Kippur is Tuesday night. Yeah, so theoretically there could be a class. I'll find out. You'll find out one way or the other. Okay, have a Shana Tova. Good day.